And now I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Del Baker from San Diego. Thank you.
Hey guys, my name is Del Baker. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. We'll see how long this jacket lasts. It's pretty warm in here. Thank Tom for asking me to come out tonight. Gave me just enough time to not be nervous, so that's good. Actually, I had plans tonight with a young lady, and I had to tell Tom, I said, I'll call you back in 15 minutes. And so I want to thank Christine for understanding and supporting me to say, you should go do that. So, I want to thank this house. I love this house. I believe God lives here. I lived here one time, and I'll tell you guys about that in my story. But first, congratulations, Mary, and congratulations, Phyllis. I mean, it could just sit down right now because you guys told my story already, and it's really the same story, wrapped in a different package. I had a few different experiences, in my journey, but the story is the same: the loneliness, the happiness in the end, and so forth. So it's like every story in the back of the big book. It all starts off with tragedy and ends in this beautiful place where God's present in our lives and we feel comfortable in our skin. So, welcome to all the people who announced themselves as counting days. We were all counting days at one time. Some of us still are, and it's just part of the deal. And I counted days for a long, long time. So I'd like to start off talking to you guys and let you know that I know those feelings of desperation. I know those feelings of I'm a piece of crap. I've ruined everything in my life. I know those things. As I look here at my buddy David, I got to say something about that. I love the support I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. That one of us goes and speaks, and usually a group of us goes and supports them. It was last minute, so I didn't get a big support group tonight, but David says, I'll be there, and that's huge to me. It's huge to me that we support each other in every area of life, and that's part of this beautiful gift that we get as well, is that we feel a part of, is what Mary said, right? We feel a part of, and that's what you have to look forward to, and I don't like to tell people what to do. I just try to tell my story, but my story is that I felt a part of nothing since a little kid. And the people who have heard me speak before know that I grew up with three things from a child, and that is I'm ugly, I'm stupid, and I can't play sports. And the truth is that I'm an engineer, so I can't be that stupid. I'm an avid volleyball player. I play advanced volleyball. And it's obvious I'm not ugly, so. that wasn't a joke, okay? but to my core, I still have those beliefs about myself, and they come up. And I'm not sober that long. I'm sober 11 years, and I lived in this house a long time before 11 years ago. So, that took what that took to get here and stay here. So I'll backtrack a second. I living in this house, I believe it was 2006, and I met the staff to do the intake, and then I met Floyd. Everybody here met Floyd? What an asshole. Man, this guy did not give you one square inch, man, anywhere. And I hated him. Man, no, that bathroom's not clean enough. Get back in there, kid. And I'm like, kid? I won't even say what I thought. But I went back in there and cleaned that bathroom. And there was reasons for that. I know that today. There was reasons for that. There's reasons why Floyd treated people that way. It's because we needed to be treated, right? The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says that we are undisciplined, and we let God discipline us. God spoke through Floyd to me. He really did. I ended up loving Floyd. I ended up loving Floyd. By the time I left here, man, actually, I was only here about 3 months, and I was already loving Floyd. Once I got out of all that shitty stuff, started following directions, and that's the one thing I got to do here was follow directions, and that's one thing I got to do in sobriety and in recovery, really, not sobriety, but in recovery. A lot of people are sober. A lot of people stay sober. But what am I doing for my recovery today? What am I doing every day of my recovery? I can't stay clean today on yesterday's shower, and I know that. So I was here about 2006. I stayed 6 months in the main house. I was trying to get in the back every chance I could. They would not let me. And I think 6 months and one day, I finally got in the back. And I didn't make it back there very long. There was a reason why they were keeping me in this front house. And Tom Clavell came back there, and he said that we need to talk. And I knew what we needed to talk about. And I had started drinking about a month before that. And I don't recommend that if you're living here. And by the time I got here to stay, got to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, I had lived in 6 recovery homes, 10 detoxes, 2 psych wards in every jail in San Diego County. The only jail I didn't live in San Diego County was South Bay, because that's where the trustees are, the people who make all the food for the other jails, and they never let me be a trustee. Always, it's like you see people get picked up and taken into detoxes. They never take me to detox. They always take me to jail. It was always still, put your hands out the window. It's for our protection and yours. We're going to cuff you. Is there any guns or drugs in the car? Well, yeah. I mean, doesn't every car have that? I mean, that's my story. I was a violent drunk. I thought I was a happy drunk, but the record didn't reflect that. And I ended up standing before a magistrate twice for terrorism. And I remember the guy, in the same week, too, I got out right away. I had this awesome attorney, this guy, Russ Lockwood in El Cajon. Oh, man, he knew every judge in town. And he'd get me out, and I was back in there in the same week, and this big guy was printing. That's back when you rolled your fingers in ink, not the electronic stuff like you young kids get now. But at the ink, and he's rolling my fingers, he goes, "You seem like such a nice guy." And I said, "I am a nice guy." But I didn't act that way when I drank. I don't know what it is. Somebody look at David wrong, and I would, we're in the bar, they look at David wrong, or they said something to him, so I would just calmly grab a chair and then hit him with it. And the bartender would, "Del, what are you doing?" Well, they looked at David wrong. I mean, it's like they deserved it. And then I ran my car into people on the road. People do something that I don't approve. And so I would ram my car into them. And sometimes I get caught. And so those hit and runs were stacking up on me, and I jam people into the curb, and I pull them out of the car, and I beat them up, and the saddest part of that is sometimes my 5-year-old daughter is sitting in the car with me when I'm doing that. And I drink in cars. I don't drink in bars. I'm a car drinker, and I like to go places when I drink. That's really enough of the ugly crap that got me here. I think that we all had to do some drinking in order to get here, and that was my drink. That's what that looked like. And by the time I'd finally gotten here, I had traded away everything in my life that was valuable to me. And not just the material stuff, the house and the job, but the wife and the kids and my own dignity. And I was seeking lower companions. I don't know how that saying goes. I was changing my habits quicker than I could change my companions, or vice versa, or whatever that is. But that's what was happening for me. And it was a slow progression. I didn't realize. I started off just drinking beer, trying to fit in with people, because I never felt a part of anything. I never felt I was never enough. Remember, I'm ugly, I'm stupid, and I can't play sports. And what happened was, is when I drank, is that I heard one gal say one time, I felt prettier, wittier, and tittier. But I could do anything on alcohol. But it started off slowly, and then stuff started going away slowly. And then I've always been an optimist. I was always like, well, I still got 2 cars. I still got a motorcycle, or I still got this. I can still work. I still go to work. And that was a big thing, too, is that I work, therefore I drink. And then people ask me, to go, "Do you have to drink every day?" I don't have to. I choose to. I work, I drink, everything. For the longest time, everything looked pretty good on the outside. So, my story is I'm in yet another recovery home. Maybe I'm there for a month or two, and they allow me to start going to work. They help you, fill out resumes. And I get a job that I can go to during the day, and I'm going to come back to it at nighttime, just like South Bay Pioneers. And and I'm going there for a while, and I'm going by the liquor store every day. And I got a sponsor, a guy that I'm saying is my sponsor, and I'm kind of faking it through the steps, and I know what that looks like today. I didn't know that they knew what I was doing at the time. But I had looked at the steps on the wall, and I was kind of trying to do them buffet style, because some of those said God in them, and that God word scared me. I was raised in the church, and in my house, if you said fart, you were going to hell. And I knew I had veered far from that path. And so when I saw those steps, I knew I couldn't do some of those. But I wanted to get sober. Every recovery home I was in, every detox I went in, I really did want to get sober. I just couldn't see that thing working for me. So I was going to try to do as best I could. So I would have some sponsor that I'm faking it with, because he doesn't know. And I'm half-assed doing these steps, and I'm getting thirsty, and I don't know it. And I'm lonely. And I'm scared, really, because I know what my life looks like when I drink now. Now I can't stay out of jail. I can't stay out of recovery homes, and I'm going past that liquor store every day on the way back home from this job that I got in whatever town that happens to be in that I'm, you know, that recovery home is this time, and it occurs to me that I just really want one 12-ounce beer. That's all I want. It's just one 12-ounce beer. Just want to feel that go in, and I start working on a plan up here, and I decide, well, you know, if I stop and get one beer, and then I slide into that recovery home right about dinner time, the smell of food's in the air, nobody will smell it, because I remember my wife couldn't smell it if I only drank one beer, and she's like, you didn't drink today, and I was like, yeah, So I'm just going to have that one beer, so I stop, and I get that one beer, and the plan worked perfectly. Slid into that recovery home. Nobody knew. I was living in this one up in Escondido. There was 12 men and 10 women that lived in this place. It was an old nursing home, and it was awesome. Really, it's a perfect mix, and so that it worked that night. And what happened was I was just going to do it that one day. But what do you think happened the next day? I had to go in there again, and so this time I got a tall boy, 16-ouncer, and one of those little airplane bottles of black velvet, because I'm a classy drinker. So I got this little black velvet, and I drink that down, and I go into that recovery home, and it worked again. And then the next day, it's really stupid to buy a half pint, isn't it? I mean, come on, the price of a half pint. You should just get a pint and drink half of it. Make sense? Everybody with me? So, two tall boys and a pint. I'm going to drink half. You know, one thing led to another. I got carried away. And I walked back into that recovery home. And sure enough, now somebody smells it. I smell alcohol. Like, you didn't smell anything, bitch. And I'm out of another recovery home. You know, I mean, that's it. And you know, the sad part is guess what happens when I lose a job, I get out of jail, I leave another recovery home. You guys all know what happens. It's on now. It's on. Within a couple of days, I'm back to my 2/5 a day. I drink 2/5 a day. I drink vodka all morning long, and I drink whiskey all night long, and a little beer in between to keep my breath fresh. I don't. It's just where I had progressed to. I started off just drinking beer to fit in, and now I'm drinking around the clock. I drink 2 hours, sleep 2 hours, drink 2 hours, sleep 2 hours. I go 6 hours without a drink, I'm gonna have a seizure. I've done it. The last 6 months of my drinking, I had 5 seizures, and I remember waking up to. And they're like, neighbors are in front of me. The ambulance is on the way. Why did you call them? And I jump in the car and take, where are you going? I said, I got to get out of here. I don't want to go and take another ambulance ride for having a seizure. And I had to go get a drink, because I'm always trying to detox by myself too. I drug my ass into Limmer Grove Alana Club. I got sober at Limmer Grove Alana Club 50, 60 times. Guys like me, you already heard about my violence. I can't go to meetings like this. You guys are all dressed up. You look so good. you talk nice and neat. I had to go to Limber Grove Volano Club where they're throwing chairs and stabbing each other. You know? Rick knows what I'm talking about. He was one of them. Yeah. So that's where I had to go because that's where I fit in. Those were my people.
Wow.
So that's my cycle, and it goes on and on. And that little girl, that daughter of mine, is finally, she's 13 years old, and she decides that she's not going to talk to me anymore. And I get her every other weekend and every Wednesday, and it's getting to where half of the time I'm supposed to be picking her up, I'm calling her up and telling her that I got a flat tire, I had to stay at work. I mean, I don't even have a job, but I had to stay at work. And she's heard enough. She doesn't want to hear it anymore, so she tells her mom, I don't want to see that man anymore. And her mom goes, you mean your father? And she says, yeah, I don't want to see him anymore. And that would start a 5-year stint that she didn't talk to me until I would get sober, and that was 2005. So about 2 years before I got sober, I became suicidal because I had it's really sunk into me. Now I've been coming around Alcoholics Anonymous for 9 years, and I just can't stay once again because I'm not willing to do those things on the wall. And I don't know it yet, but I know it today. When I get to a place I just don't want to live anymore. And I know I'm not alone in this room. There's a lot of people in here that got to a place where they just don't want to live. It's just not worth it. Can't do this thing. It's just, I can't do life. I don't know how to do life. The most basic things in life I can't do. That last week before I finally got sober, living on the guy's couch in Ocean Beach, and this is a guy who taught me my trade from 30 years before that, and he gets up every morning, and goes to work, and I go down to the liquor store and get some more booze, and I sit in front of the volleyball courts at Dog Beach down there, and I drink my 2 hours, sleep 2 hours, drink 2 hours, sleep 2 hours, And for whatever reason, I decide that day that I'm gonna go to a hospital again. And so I go to a hospital and I'm in there and you know, you go to a hospital and you don't have insurance but you do have alcoholism. They're really not very nice to you. They just make sure you don't die on their watch. They pump you full of fluids and make sure that you're gonna live another hour, and they kick you out the door. And that's what they did this time. It happened to me many times before in many cities And I came out in the parking lot. I had driven myself there, and I came out in the parking lot, and there was that guy who was letting me stay on his couch. And he says, now what are you going to do? And I said, Mike, how do you even know that I'm here? And he says, it doesn't matter how I know that you're here, Del. It matters that they told me that your blood alcohol level was 0.47 and that you were going to, that early death was imminent, and that you were probably going to die on my couch. And he says, and I don't want anybody dead on my couch. And I'll tell you what, that was a really important day for me. Because I had made a promise to myself that I didn't realize that I also, like Randy said, I was not going to live outside. I had a healthy fear of living outside. I'd seen a lot of people in my years coming around Alcoholics Anonymous that had lived outside, and that was not for me. And I decided that I told him, I said, I'm going to go to another hospital. That's what I'm going to do. And he says, all right, well, you need to do something. And I remember getting in the truck thinking, I'm screwed. The jig was up, because I'm not going to live outside. I can't stop drinking. It's been 11 years at this point trying to do this. So I go back down to Dog Beach, and I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, today's the day. And I got a plan. I'm gonna go out Highway 8 out towards the desert. You get out there by Yucumba, that area out there past Pine Valley where those big, huge bridges are, and there's nothing but big rocks. There's a perfect spot that I can launch this old beat-up truck that I got right off of next to one of those bridges. There's no way I could live because I'd seen people try to kill themselves before and not succeed, and that's an ugly picture too. And I know that I got to do this. And for whatever reason, I checked my bottle of Black Velvet. I had a half a fifth of Black Velvet. I turned the key on, and I had a half a tank of gas, and I thought, I can make it. And for whatever reason, I looked out the window, and I said, look, if there really is a God out there, then show me a sign. And I'll tell you, the truck did not shake, and there was no bright light. But something came over me that said, Dale, you never did this. Matter of fact, the guy's voice from Lima Grove Lawn Club said, Dale, next time you're out there running and gunning, don't tell people that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work, because you never done it. You never did this all these years. And I had people in there that would tell me, Dale, give us back all those 30-day tokens and sitting back, man. This is ridiculous. And then other people that would just come up and hug me and kiss me and tell me, you're going to make it one of these days. And that's what I say to you guys that are in here counting days. You're going to make it one of these days. Because that's what they told me, and I finally got to stay. And right there, in that moment, there was no bright light and the truck didn't shake. I surrendered completely. I surrendered completely to something I couldn't identify. I just knew that something said, Dale, go do it. Give it one last try. Another guy at that Lima Grove Lawn Club would say, he would say, Dale, give it a hockey season. Be all in for 6 months. And if it doesn't work, then go kill yourself. I mean, it was brutal, but I had told people I told them my plan. I didn't tell them exactly what I was going to do, but I said, I'm ready to kill myself. And I went to my last detox. I went to VOA this last time, and it was the easiest detox I ever had. I have to medically detox because of the volume, the amount of alcohol that I drank, and so they gave me my Valium. I took it as prescribed this time. Well, actually, they distributed it out to me, but I stayed the whole time. I didn't cut out early. You know, the other times, two or three days, I could do this at home. There's no reason to stay here. And so I stayed the whole 15 days this time. And this time I didn't go to a recovery home or a sober liver or anything. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because ultimately, this is where we all go. Right? We all end up going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, those recovery homes, they have a place. This place that has a place. But if I'm going to stay years and years and years in a recovery, it's a purgatory. So... And my journey began. And I'll tell you, my early sobriety was pretty ugly. I still live the alcoholic life. I was working about 75 hours a week. I was building bicycles like crazy. I don't know why. And I was building bicycles like crazy. And somebody came over one day, and I was renting out. I had my garage below my apartment, and I was renting out two neighbors. And I had building cars and motorcycles and bicycles. And somebody comes over, and they go, man, you got a lot of bikes in here. And I said, I got beach cruisers and road bikes and off-road bikes, a little bit of everything. They go, we never see you ride them. And I said, I don't ride them. And it was the first time that I'd probably a year sober or so. It was the first time somebody said, you know, you're still really living alcoholically. You're building all these bicycles. Are you selling them? No, I'm just building them. But that's the way I roll. I had an 80-inch television in this one bedroom. Oh, man. You walk in there, it was like going to the drive-in. Like, what's the big television? I said, well, I like to see the guy throw the football and the guy catch it all on one screen. It was pretty wild. I started going to God's Garage there in Pacific Beach. Well, while I was in that detox, back up shortly, a guy came in there on an H&I panel, and he said... And this guy was a heroin addict, but he got his found his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Jeremy, and he darted all around, man. This guy could not stop moving, and it was the first time as I'm watching him, I'm going, man, this guy's crazier than me, because in all these years with my eyes closed and my ears closed, I never met anybody who was as crazy as me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never met anybody who drank as much as me. Now, I can tell you, since I've been around now, that I've met a few people that drank as much as me and more, and a lot of people who are crazier than me. But my eyes were finally open. My ears were finally open, and I'm watching this guy bouncing back and forth up in front, and he says, you know, we meet every day down in Pacific Beach. Come and join us. And I thought, well, what else am I doing? I did have a job at the time. I was in OB. I can make it up there. I still got that beat-up old truck. So I started going to that meeting, that very first meeting came out. I don't know what was said in that meeting, but I know Jeremy was there, and I know what that feels like to walk into a meeting brand new and at least identify one person. It's like I want to just run over and hug him, but fortunately he came and hugged me. And And this guy comes up after the meeting, and he says, do you want to do this thing? And I said, do what? And he says, the 12 steps. And you ever say something you just want to, like, suck it back in? That's what happened that morning. I said, yeah, I do. And that man saved my life. I mean, God saved my life. But that man met with me every day. And the very first day, he says, okay, what I need you to do is you need to pray. Okay, how's your prayer? And I said, oh, my prayer is, I got a problem with God. I don't do the prayer thing. He said, well, then I won't work with you. If you can't pray, I can't work with you. I can't, you know, you're going to have to pray to something. He goes, you have to pray to something in the morning and ask it to help you stay sober today. And then after you've stayed sober all day, I want you to pray to whatever that was you prayed to in the morning and thank it for keeping you sober. Can you do that or not? I said, I can do it. And I started off doing that. And I'm meeting this guy every morning after the meeting, and we start going through the big book and start doing the steps together. And I tell him after a month or two, I say, I'm still praying, but it's all mechanical. I don't feel anything. Feel nothing. Only doing it because you said so. And he goes, that's all right, keep praying. And eventually around, I don't know, step six or step seven, I didn't know what to do about a God. And he says, well, you know, is the ocean stronger than you? And I said, yeah, I got a scar on my back where the ocean is. Well, have the ocean be your God. I go, that's stupid. And everything he suggested was really stupid. But but I stuck with it because I'm going to do a hockey season. And what happened was, is one day I started feeling like I was solving situations that used to baffle me. Sound familiar? And I said to this smart-ass sponsor, I said, you know, something's happening that's kind of weird. He goes, what do you mean? I said, I'm just like figuring stuff out at work and with my car and with people that it just doesn't seem like that's me. He goes, really, still praying? And I said, yeah. And he says, what are you praying to anyway? About time you tell me. And I said, well, and I'm half joking, but I said, you know, I'm a competitive driver. And I said, as I'm driving to work, going up the freeway, I'm dodging this. People are cutting in front of me, and I'm cutting in front of them. And I talked to this empty seat next to me. And I said, is it okay if my God's an invisible NASCAR driver? And he said, perfect. And I'll tell you this, my first year and a half of my recovery, my God was an invisible NASCAR driver. And I don't know what that looks like today. I don't even want to try to describe it, but it's just, it's really the same dude. It might even be getting closer to the guy with the beard, you know, up in the sky with the white robe. I don't know, because I'm living a cleaner and cleaner life all the time. But that's what that looked like that first year or two. And you know, I just started I started getting things like my teeth fixed, fixing my credit, expunging my criminal record. So things started, it seemed like every 2 years, something pretty big was happening in my life. Eventually I got to buy a home of my own. Is that crazy? A gutter drunk like me, who rams his car into people, is buying real estate. Wow, it's crazy. So I want to tell you a couple stories. And what do I have? Do I have like 10 more minutes? Is that what you got? I'm part of this group, Mount Soledad Men's. I'm at part of a few different men's groups. I feel like I'm right in the middle of AA. I know what it's like to be in AA and on AA, because I was on AA for a long time. A friend of mine describes it, being in AA is like being in a submarine, and being on AA is like being on a submarine. And when the submarine takes a dive, you know whether you're in it or on it. So I'm in AA. I'm a full-time member. I get full-time benefits. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that I have this great life because of that. And I get to go meet with these men every week, different groups of men around town. And one of them, we go to this retreat. Mount Soledad Men's does a couple of retreats a year up at Julian. And every Saturday, for years there, they would have some kind of strenuous event, but sometimes it was softball. And what happened to me when I was a little kid, I was 10 years old, is that the reason I can't play sports in my head is that I was playing, they put me out in the outfield playing baseball after church one day. and somebody hit a fly ball, and I'm running to get that ball, and it's going right into my glove, and people are going, catch it, Dell, catch it, Dell. And the ball landed like 20 or 30 feet away from me. And I don't know what was said that day, but I know the tape that's been playing in my head ever since. And so what happened at these men's retreats, I'm about 5 years sober. And I'm at one of these retreats, which are really spiritual retreats. I feel so close to God and all these men, and we get vulnerable. And every time they go play softball, I take a nap. I go, I'm gonna take a nap. I'm a little tired. You guys go ahead. And I got this big secret. And finally, 1 year, one of these retreats, this one guy goes, we're eating breakfast. He goes, we're playing softball today. And he was a big baseball. He goes, Dell, man, you'd be a perfect third baseman. You're right-handed, right? Goes, oh, yeah, you have a long reach. You'll be able to reach out there and grab that ball. You play third base. And before I knew it, he had lassoed me into it. And I went and played softball. And I'll tell you what, I've been playing ever since. It's one of the things that happened to me in there. And something that was even bigger is that another secret of mine is that I'm stupid. So I'm an engineer, but I don't know how to do trigonometry. And I've been hiding that for decades. And I'm sitting in this group of men, six men, and we're sitting there and we're bearing our souls, and people are crying and saying how their father was a fireman and they started a forest fire. And I mean, the stories are coming out, and I come clean. I'm an engineer, and I don't know how, and I'm crying. I don't know how to do trig, and I'm a fraud. And one of the guys in that group, he's an inspector in aerospace, he said, Dell, you know, you just like multiply one number times the other number, you get that third egg. I said, really, is it that easy? And he said, yeah. But it's moments like that that I become vulnerable. That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get the opportunity to become vulnerable, to come clean about things. That doesn't happen for guys like me, egomaniacs with an inferiority complex out there in the regular world. But it happens in rooms like this. It happens in my men's groups. Sometimes it happens. I've had some women get right in my face and tell me, Dell, leave the newcomers alone. Wow. You know, I mean, that's some brutal things. I mean, I've learned some beautiful things in Alcoholics Anonymous, how to grow up. Right before COVID hit, I was down in Puerto Vallarta. I'd been fortunate to go on vacations every year since I got sober, and the last few years I've been going on with this group called Sober Vacations International. Ever get a chance to do those? They're fabulous. They go everywhere, Turks and Caicos. They'll be in Hawaii in November. 570 of us took over a resort down in Puerto Vallarta February of last year. And they took all the booze out of the resort. And we just had a ball for a week. We boat rides, went ate in town, and had meetings every day. It was just awesome. One day we're coming up off the beach, and we got our circle of, I don't know, eight of us or so coming up off the beach and up into the resort, and it's this real sandy concrete drive that to walk up. And I was a little unsure-footed, but I was walking with a lady that needed some help, and we get to the top, and I'm kind of, taking inventory of care. We all here, and my friend Big Mike, if you guys saw him, you'd know I'm not going to give away his anonymity, but Big Mike goes back down the ramp. And I thought, Mike must have forgot something down there. And he comes back up, and there's a stranger with him. And I, maybe he knows her from somewhere else. I don't know, 570 of us. And then he goes back down the ramp. And he comes up, and he's got another stranger with him. And he goes back down the ramp. And it took three times for me to realize that that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be following Mike's lead and going down there and helping people up that ramp. That's what you guys have been trying to teach me in here. Not sound good behind the microphone, not sound good reading the book and talking about it, but what do I do in real life? What do I do when I'm outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? Am I practicing these principles in all my affairs, or am I just talking about practicing these principles in all my affairs? Some of the biggest moments of my life. I get to go to meetings with that man every week these days. Every week. And he talks about being a little boy in a big man's body. And I know exactly what he's talking about. And I know some of you men know exactly what I'm talking about too. Because right? Still inside, I'm just this little boy in this grown man's body who's still insecure. And because, and that's a feature of my disease, and I know that. I get a built-in awfulizer, and it tells me that I'm not enough all the time. You guys tell me I'm enough, it tells me I'm not enough. And it's through those actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, the things I learned with you guys, that I actually get to feel enough. I've been doing H&I since I was about 6 weeks sober. You're not supposed to do that until you're 6 months sober, but I'm not a big rule follower, as you've probably figured out. And for the longest time, I would drive from Pacific Beach out to Lemon Grove, out to McAllister Institute, and go out there and talk with those folks out there in detox. I love detox. I love people ready to make a change, just like me. You know, just shaken and just at the lowest spot in their life and just ready to make a change. That's why the guys work here. Because they love seeing that. Right, Tom? Sometimes I hate driving out there. So fucking long to drive out. There's an hour to drive out there in traffic. It took me 15 minutes just to get out of PB. Then barely make it there on time to go in there and do this detox panel. But I'll tell you, every time I leave there, I feel better. And half the times, at least, I cry all the way home because of the experience that I had in there. I'll tell you what, until you had somebody, well, I wouldn't tell you, I'm not giving any advice. It's an amazing feeling. Somebody walks up to you in a meeting and says, "You're Dell, right? You came into my detox. Look, I'm sober. I'm doing it. So I got like 4 weeks now," or something like, "But that's awesome. I don't know your name. Give me a hug." I mean, man, when that happens, it makes every one of those trips worthwhile to go out there. So I want to end. I want to end with something about this relationship with God and how I still don't really understand it, yet I do, and how it transpires in my life. I have a friend that says, "I go to meetings to see God." Now, I wouldn't say that that's exactly my story, because I have it that God answers my prayers within 24 hours. Just a lot of times I don't like the answer. So I think, he's not getting back to me yet, but usually he has. And but God speaks to me through you guys, and it's those acts like Mike, and it's acts like David when we were sitting in a place one night, and half of our crew left the restaurant, went into the sober people, went in and started dancing in the bar, and David and I stayed there at the table because we had a newcomer with us, and we weren't going to go take him into the bar. And David said to me, he said, "You know, I don't want to go in that bar." And I said, "No, David, why?" He said, "Because people aren't acting spiritual in there." There's nothing wrong with bars. I love bars. But David's right. I'm not going to feel spiritual in there. So that connection goes like this. And this is how, this is what brings it around for me. And it's a poem that's on the wall in Notre Dame. And it goes like this. It says, "I sought my God, I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But when I sought my brother, I found all three." Thank you, guys.
I'd like to thank Dell. Please come back and visit us very soon. That was incredible. Let's all thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for an incredible dinner. Don't forget, there's cake in a little bit, and we can close in our usual manner with the Lord's Prayer.